Radio and Sante Aesthetics and Wellness are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. The event takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kbu.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.
KBU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Enemigo Imperialismo, Enemy Imperialism, a bilingual community art exhibit that explores the dimensions of imperialism in the world today. The opening of this art show will be Friday, September 5th at 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, 1001 Southeast Division Street in Portland. Artists around the world have responded to violence with work that questions the legitimacy of the state and empire. Enemigo Imperialismo points to one of our common targets in the fight for global justice and invites us to reflect on power, resistance, and self-determination. Again, that's Enemigo Imperialismo. The opening of this art show will be Friday, September 5th at 6 p.m. at the Independent Publishing Resource Center, 1001 Southeast Division Street in Portland. The show will be up until September 25th. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
Good morning, Portland, yeah!
I'm your host, Joe Clement, for the Old Mole Variety Hour. You are listening to it on KBOO Portland. That's 90.7 FM on your dial or KBOO.FM online. The Old Mole Variety Hour comes to you every Monday morning with a smorgasbord of interviews, commentary, reviews, and analysis from our radical anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist, socialist, anarcho-syndicalist, feminist perspective. The mole we embody is the revolutionary mole, a spirit animal for us because of its subterranean process, rooting around in what by all appearances seems to be foundational and solid. The Old Mole Variety Hour comes to you every Monday morning with interviews, reviews, commentary, and analysis from our radical perspective. We focus on issues of politics and culture that are illuminated by a socialist and feminist perspective, and are equal parts critical and aspirational. I start today's show talking with Nathan Schneider about Who Stole the 4-Hour Workday. Old Mole's Bill Resnick and Norm Diamond will be discussing the meaning of Labor Day and real union organizing by way of a conversation about Jane McKelvey's book, Raising Expectations, Raising Hell, My Decade, Fighting for the Labor Movement. And then toward the end of the show, I am joined by Kathy Weeks, author of a book, The Problem with Work, to talk about utopianism. And in between some of these interviews, we will hear some political humor from the late Robin Williams. You can listen to past shows of The Old Mole in their entirety or as their segments by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour and clicking on the audio tab a little ways down the screen. There you can find links also to mentioned material. Look for The Old Mole on Facebook and Twitter to get updates. After a little musical break, we will start the show with my conversation with Nathan Schneider. So I'm joined by Nathan Schneider. Nathan Schneider wrote an article recently that I liked a lot called Who Stole the 4-Hour Day? He wrote that for Vice magazine. He is also an editor of Waging Nonviolence, and his articles appear in Harper's and New York Times and and Chronicle of Higher Education, and I wanted to bring him on today to talk about this very special topic of the four-hour day. Thanks for joining us, Nathan.
Oh, it's great to be on. It's great to have an opportunity to have a conversation about this important stuff.
Let's just kind of go over what you wrote, what the four-hour day was, and the stakes of its loss.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I kind of take as my starting point the conversations that are always churning in media of all sorts these days about work-life balance, about how people can live decent lives in the midst of what seem like impossible demands at work as well as home. And it's just striking to me how kind of impoverished those conversations are now compared to how they have been in the past, that we're still really stuck in this framework of 8 hours or more of work. And that made me want to dive a bit into the history and figure out what happened and to bring back some of those visions of really radically shorter hours, which were so common 60, 70, 80 years ago.
We've heard of the 8-hour day. What was special about the 4-hour day?
Well, the 4-hour day was a vision that has taken a lot of different forms, has been articulated by a lot of different people. For instance, in the colonial period, Benjamin Franklin talked about a 4 hours as a reasonable amount of time for people to work, given even technological advancement at that point, which is striking to think of. And then it started to be articulated again in the 20th century, in the midst of the struggle for an 8-hour workday that was taking place across the labor movement at the time. Some of the more radical groups, including the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World, were pushing that conversation even further and saying, okay, now we're fighting for 8 hours, but we should also be talking about the possibility of 4 hours. We shouldn't stop at 8. And that as productivity increases and as automation makes our labor more efficient, we should continue to demand shorter and shorter working hours. They talked about this as the revolutionary demand because they recognized that if you stop that fight for shorter working hours, then the increased value that workers are creating will just get sucked up by the 1%, by the owning class. And that's exactly what's happened in the years since the late 30s when the 8-hour day really got stabilized in the United States. We've seen increasing inequality, and we've seen, in many ways, less control over work and hours among many American workers. And so I think it's a really important moment for us to turn back to that legacy, to reconsider what some of those early radicals were thinking about, explore what application it might have to our time.
And in a way, the numbers almost don't matter. What matters is how they evoke a sense of being in control of the majority of our own time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for instance, some people responding to my article were saying, well, I don't want 4-hour work days. I want, one day a week of work or something like that. I think that's great. And I think the trope of the 4-hour day is it should be a jumping off point for a much broader conversation about what progress really looks like for us. You know, I think we've accepted that progress will involve continuing to work basically with all the best hours of our lives, continuing to work in non-democratic workplaces. And that's very strange. I mean, you look at the science fiction of just a few decades ago. You look at the sociology of the 1960s and, you know, into the 70s even. And there was this presumption that this kind of regimented work would gradually disappear. And, you know, in recent decades, we've just stopped even questioning that we will continue working forever until we're dead, more and more, especially now as even retirement is under threat. So I think that the first step for many people is just to open up the conversation and then talk about the details later.
I want to go back to the 1930s, both when the 8-hour day became solidified into U.S. federal law, and also when John Maynard Keynes was writing about how, you know, 80 or 100 years from his time, we would be having not these job questions, but these challenges of what to do with our leisure time. Could you say a little bit about how the 40-hour work week became established into law?
It's so amazing to think that in 1932, both presidential candidates, Republican and Democrat, Herbert Hoover and FDR, ran on the idea of a 6-hour workday in order to deal with unemployment. I mean, can you imagine both parties recognize this seemed like a valid approach for dealing with unemployment. And bills that were circulating in Congress and actually, you know, getting through houses of Congress were pushing that idea forward. So it was very close. But industry started pushing back really hard on FDR. And by 1938, when the labor law finally passed, 8 hours was really enshrined in the law and in people's consciousness. And the Cold War that followed World War II really solidified that. It removed the radicals from the unions who were talking about shorter hours. And it really became the occasion for building a consensus of full employment, of full-time work. I think it's also important to remember that throughout the history of our movements for shorter hours, whether it's in the 1830s with the Lowell factory women calling for 10 hours or the later struggles for 8 hours, that those calls always accompanied discussions about what to do with that time, what to do with leisure. The women in Lowell were talking about education. At other times, women have talked about family. Throughout these struggles, it's always been so important to articulate not just the need for shorter working hours, but the need for, you know, really worthwhile ways of spending our time, doing something better than watching TV all the time, which, you know, I think a lot of people fear today maybe is what would happen if all of a sudden working hours were to be cut in half.
Yeah, and I don't think it's too surprising that people have that fear, considering what was also on the rise in the mid-20th century as the eight-hour workday seemed to become the plateau, is also this consumer culture and these new forms of consumption that would dig even deeper into workers as far as producing a need to work. So the explosion of home ownership and of motor culture creates all of these property demands on workers, which in a way kind of rationalizes their need for work when they might actually enjoy their lives in different ways.
Absolutely. And education is really critical, too. You know, in the 30s and 40s, the president of the University of Chicago, Robert Hutchins, articulated very clearly a vision of education as training for leisure, a way of learning to use leisure in a way that would be constructive for civilization, advancing knowledge and growing in wisdom. And that kind of idea of education has really been lost. Now, you know, we're tricked into thinking that the purpose of even a liberal arts education is to get a job, which is ridiculous. It's a terrible job training program. And as a result, I think we've really lost even the ambition of training each other for the use of leisure. All we care about is training the young for jobs, you know, which means that as a result, people aren't really prepared for dealing with leisure. So if we're going to talk about shortening work hours, we also need to talk about what is worth doing with leisure.
There are still contradictions in that, considering there is a literature out there about what to do with our time, but it's always, you know, gearing us back towards consumption and not really doing things with our time that don't require the exchange of money with people who've built something for us.
You know, I think this is a question about democracy in the end. You know, this is about democratizing time and democratizing the economy. If we have more time to do, as early labor movements have said, to do what we will, then we suddenly have a democratic problem that we actually don't have so much right now. We have to figure out what is really worth our time. And I think that conversation becomes all the more urgent, if there's more of it. And I think that's a really important conversation. It's one that we don't really have time for right now, but it's one that I hope people will begin to have with more and more seriousness.
You bring up the issue of democracy, and when I've talked with Anna Coote about this on The Old Mole before, she works in Britain with a nonprofit called New Economics Foundation. Freeing up time is not just a matter of leisure, but that there's actually all kinds of other work that's not work in the form of drudgery, but just, you know, work in the sense that things have to happen. And so when we have more time, we can actually become informed to participate in democracy, but we can also do things slower and help leverage, you know, more environmentally sustainable ways of living. People very understandably, frustratingly, don't let go of their cars because they need that kind of instant travel for a lot of the demands that they have in work society. But if they had more time, it would seem more realistic or less of a challenge to actually try and, say, navigate public transit or take bikes.
There are so many great points you make there, and I really recommend Anna Coote's reports for the NEF. which have been very provocative for me, as have conversations with her. But absolutely, and you're alluding too to the gendered nature of this question and the reason why so many of the movements for shorter working hours through history have been led by women, and this continues to this day. I think alongside this question of the length of the workday and what counts as work, you know, there needs to be a question about who does the housework. You know, we kind of inherited a stereotypical vision of what a family looks like, you know, with a breadwinning male going to quote unquote work, and then a female who stays at home and quote unquote doesn't work. And clearly we need to reevaluate those categories. I also think, that we have to refine our vocabulary in a lot of ways here. For instance, I'm someone with a pretty strong work ethic. I believe in a strong work ethic, and maybe leisure doesn't quite capture that. What I would love to do personally is spend more time working in non-market activity. You know, I'd like to spend more time developing ideas, studying, researching, learning, developing my work, so to speak, but not necessarily in a way where I'm constantly serving the market. You know, imagine if more researchers were able to pursue work that didn't necessarily have a financial outcome or an immediate one. I imagine that innovation would increase, that, you know, that civilization would develop far more quickly and more habitably and humanely if we were able to do our work in ways that weren't necessarily dictated by the short-term needs of the market.
Well, that's all the time that we have for the on-air portion of this conversation. If you tune into the online version of this conversation, you'll find a few more minutes of content as me and Nathan dive into some of these questions more deeply. I've been talking with Nathan Schneider, author of a recent article in Vice magazine called Who Stole the 4-Hour Workday, which is what we were talking about today. We'll link it to the page when this is posted. Thanks for joining us, Nathan.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I would like to begin by doing some basic Soviet suppressions for you. My first suppression is Karl Marx, and for those of you on drugs, Karl Marx. Karl Marx, take one. Imperialism is the worst thing I've ever heard. Wait. I'd like to do for you some Soviet ventriloquism. Here is for you. Nikki, how do you like being in America? We're all set. Time for some culture now. Some poetry to enlighten your brief day. Here it is, my first poem. Red sand between my toes, summer vacation in outer space. That was a Martian haiku. Now a simpler poem, a poem written on acid entitled Abir. Abir. Amilabar. Eve Arden. Bibir. Those of you who understood it went, wow, reality, what a concept.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host. And before that, we heard the late Robin Williams giving the signature joke from his reality, what a concept routine from the late 1970s. And before that, I was talking with Nathan Schneider about Who Stole the 4-Hour Workday. Today is Labor Day in the United States, which is a little odd considering in most countries, Labor Day or its equivalent is May 1st, also known as International Workers' Day. According to the federal government's Department of Labor website, quote, the first governmental recognition came through municipal ordinances passed during 1885 and 1886. From these, a movement developed to secure state legislation. The first state bill was introduced into the New York legislature, but the first to become law was passed in Oregon on February 21, 1887. During the year, four more states, Colorado, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and New York, created the Labor Day holiday by legislative enactment. By the end of the decade, Connecticut, Nebraska, and Pennsylvania had followed suit. By 1894, 23 other states had adopted the holiday in honor of workers, and on June 28th of that year, Congress passed an act making the first Monday in September of each year a legal holiday in the District of Columbia and the territories. End quote. What it fails to mention is the relationship between the national establishment of the holiday in 1894 and the Pullman strike of 1894. During the Pullman strike, over 10,000 National Guard troops were deployed against well over 100,000 striking railway workers being led by Eugene Debs, resulting in the death of at least two of them. A bill creating the national holiday was passed in Congress later that year to appease workers, though it didn't help Grover Cleveland get reelected. We'll be back in a few minutes after another worker-themed musical interlude to hear from Bill Resnick and Norm Diamond talking about Jane McAlavey's book Raising Expectations, Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. Listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was Dropkick Murphys with Worker's Song. Now I'd like to hand it over to Bill Resnick and Norm Diamond to talk about Jane McAlavey's book, Raising Expectations, Raising Hell, My Decade Fighting for the Labor Movement. They consider a lot of things, but pay close attention to what they have to say about direct action in the workplace.
Hi, folks. It's Labor Day. Labor Day, a day to celebrate the working class, who, in distinction to the predatory 1% elite, that working class built and carries this country. Labor Day, it's also a day to mourn the decline of the labor movement, And Labor Day, it's a day to think and reflect on the problems and also the opportunities of the labor movement, and especially to talk about some recent successes in organizing, why they occurred, whether they can be emulated. I'm Bill Resnick of the Old Mole Collective, here with Norm Diamond, also an Old Mole. Norm has taught political science, written a lot. Norm and Bill Bigelow did the book Power in Our Hands about U.S. labor struggles. It includes numerous role plays that introduce students to real historical struggles and the choices people made, workers made, and how they organized. Norm was also president of the Pacific Northwest Labor College. Norm, why don't you first introduce us to Jane McAlevey's book?
Thank you, Bill. Happy Labor Day. That was a very non-cynical take on what Labor Day is. Labor Day, of course, is traditionally the end of summer, the kind of the stretch run of the baseball season, time for picnics, time for glad-handing politicians to show up at the small percentage of U.S. workers who are in unions and have a coordinated picnic today, mainly to meet the politicians. There's my cynical take on Labor Day. It didn't used to be that way. It was a day for celebrating workers and their capabilities, just the way you said. We have today a book Bill and I are going to talk about, and I want to give you the counterpart introduction to Bill in just a moment. The book is by Jane McAlevey. It's called Raising Expectations and Raising Hell. And it's about good experiences and the possibilities of overcoming the lethargy and the decline in the labor movement. It's a book that respects workers and their capabilities and talks about the possibility of building rank-and-file, controlled rank-and-file unions as a way out of the kind of malaise of the labor movement. Bill is a member of the National Writers Union himself. Bill is, of course, co-founder. You all know him as a longtime old mole. He's been a lawyer. He's been a teacher. And, of course, he brings that union credential as well. Bill, want to go back to the labor movement as setting the context for our talking about the McAlevey book?
Yeah, let me talk about the decline of the labor movement. It's rapidly losing members, down to 7% of private employment. The only growth is in public workers, and that's slowing down. As to why it's declining, there are many, many factors, of course, and different writers emphasize different ones. I'll just offer a short list, starting with the external factors that sort of gives us some background to Jane McAlevey's achievement. So first, there's the dispersal of working people. The old densely packed urban neighborhoods clustered around huge factories and churches and working men's bars that all facilitated organizing, that's long gone. Second, all employers, they've all become agile, mobile, threaten their workers to leave the city and find some workers who actually appreciate having work and income, and workers threatened with the loss of their jobs are terrified, and it's really difficult to organize, and that threat is now used in every contract dispute and in every organizing effort, and it's a real threat to people. Even employers who can't move have gained powers to contract out or lease workforces or in the public sector privatize and thus replace their current workers who are too uppity with more passive and agreeable people if the workers don't toe the line. In addition, U.S. labor law is weak, has virtually no enforcement, and is useful for union busting and avoiding law firms to exhaust workers and kill organizing drives, often illegally, but there are very few penalties, and they only occur, the penalties, years and years after the violation. Then, of course, there are the internal problems that have to be surmounted, and that is many union leaders, especially at the national level, become entrenched, spend more time putting down rebellions in their ranks, protecting their positions, than in fighting the bosses with whom, and often their fellow millionaires, they have chummy relations. Then there's racism and sexism, which is declining but persists. There's dependence on the Democratic Party that has gone mostly corporate, yet weakened labor, depending on them, still supports them financially because surely they are better than the conservatives who would destroy labor in one swipe. Then the unions are plagued by organizing failures and poor leadership and insufficient organizing training and little effort to educate and mobilize the rank and file. Again, because once mobilized in battle with the employer, they can also mobilize to take power in the union. I guess that's the realistic, cynical view, Norm, but that's not the whole story of unions. All organizing, including shop floor workers who are organizing their fellow workers, they all face these problems, but they often succeed. They form powerful locals. How do they do it? Tell us about what Jane McAlevey did.
Often may be an overstatement, of course, Bill. It's been happening with much too little frequency. What's inspiring about this particular book? And the book has problems, and maybe we'll get to them as well. But what's inspiring about the account of McAlevey's experience is her success and the success of the workers with whom she worked in three different contexts. In the book, she's part of an organizing effort in Connecticut and then in Kansas City. And then much of the book focuses on hospital organizing in Nevada, in Las Vegas specifically. Start, I guess, with her vision of what organizing is. And you can tell a bit from just the title, Raising Expectations, and then in parentheses, and Raising Hell, Raising Expectations. It would seem to be a truism that, of course, that's what organizing is about, is encouraging people to have higher senses of their own capabilities, of their capabilities of working together with others, and of what they can accomplish. But often among organizers, and I encounter this a lot in the labor movement, often among organizers, what organizing means is getting someone to join the institution. And that's a very different understanding than developing capabilities. So all the way through this book, I'm implicit and then very explicit and with graphic details of how to do it is Jane McAlevey's sense that organizing consists of developing worker capabilities.
Right, but Norm, almost all organizers do raise expectations as to what workers are entitled to with regard to wages, hours, and often health care. It's not that they don't raise expectations, but what they don't do is, as you pointed out, it seems to me enough, is help people become more effective themselves, help people stand up to the boss, help people recognize their own power, that is, their collective power in the workplace. There's a lot more to it, much more intense, than just getting people to sign cards and then hold an election and hold your breath.
It's a doubly difficult task because, in part, what you're doing as an organizer then is preparing people to replace you. So her vision of organizing is, first place, finding people who exhibit some of those capabilities right from the beginning. She calls them, what does she call them, organic leaders, natural leaders. So in a workplace and in a community, this is a vision of organizing that goes beyond a workplace, finding people that other people turn to and get their opinion. So finding them, training them, because she's got a kind of methodology involved, and we can talk about that, but having them increasingly take over the kind of role that staff have been doing usually now in most of the unions that we have. We have staff doing things for members. Here the vision is having members do things for themselves, and then secondarily, having those people themselves convert into organizers of others so that those capabilities spread, of course, throughout the union.
And ultimately, to make the entire union into an organizing front that will talk to others, that will, in fact, go into the community and go way beyond just labor organizing and the traditional goals of labor, but in fact become forces in the community for the kinds of values that people like nurses stand for. And all the other people that she organized, the Stanford low-level service workers, all of them had deep community concerns, and McAlevey gave people a sense, to some extent, that, I mean, that's one of the critiques of the book, too. There just wasn't enough time to do everything. But she helped people find and articulate their values, and they were community values. They were larger values than just expressed in the workplace.
I want to mention that this is a very easy reading book and very engrossing because she does focus so concretely on the experience, on her own experience in working with people. So basically, she's written a storytelling book that shows possibilities. And think of the implications of what we've just been talking about, this generating capabilities. It means that every opportunity, everything that comes up is an opportunity for education, for empowering people to stand up for themselves, to stand up against the boss. Take, for example, how most unions in most workplaces operate, not only where the staff does things for workers, but where procedures are laid out in a contract, like grievance handling. She's very explicit in rejecting grievance handling and favoring direct action. You have an empowered workplace. You have the workers together deciding what needs to be done and responding and enforcing, you know, exercising their own power on the workplace instead of going through procedures defined in a contract that basically take issues out of workers' hands. There's a problem. We solve it through our collective action right here and now. And of course, as any good organizer will tell you, that's when people learn best, is in situations of conflict, in situations of struggle, in situations where they've got to transcend their own comfort zone. And so that's a big part of her emphasis.
What do you mean by direct action, actually?
Yeah, you wanted an example, for instance.
Yeah, right.
And someone is abused by a foreperson in the workplace, say. And what that means in most situations is you file a grievance. You fill out a sheet of paper, hand it to your shop steward, your business agent, whatever. They take it up with management, or they don't take it up with management. They put it in a pile. And when there are a certain number, they go and take them up with management and use them as kind of bargaining tools. You know, you grant 20 of our grievances and we'll drop 10 and, you know, we'll negotiate over it. That's the way things work now. And often, I mean, I'm familiar with the UAW, the automobile workers, the number of grievances can grow into the hundreds before there's any real action taken on them. Direct action means instead of filling out that paper and handing it to the union officials to deal with, workers themselves say, well, we're not going to proceed with our work, or we're going to slow down, or we're going to set up a picket line, or we're going to take any one of a number of different kinds of actions until this particular problem is resolved.
Even just challenge, if enough people do it and say, look, you were really out of line, you can't continue doing this, and you're alienating us, and you know you can't run this place without us, often managers will find a better self.
Yeah, or that particular problem authority figure, foreperson or whatever, will depart. There's an instance in this book where a foreman is fired as a result of direct action taken by the workers.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Here with Norm Diamond. It's Labor Day. We're talking about organizing today. We began with the problems of the labor union. There are organizers who have surmounted them. We're talking about one of them today. Jane McAlevey did her book, Raising Expectations and Raising Hell. It's a really good read, actually. It's an exciting story, in fact. It becomes a page-turner of the struggles with some really callous and powerful hospitals who finally threw in the towel. She's a terrific organizer, and she talks about how to do it. Norm, let's talk about her methods and the way she brought people to raise not just their expectations about what they deserve in terms of money, but raise their understandings of their own capacities and of the kinds of values that they brought to the workplace in distinction to what management did.
No shortcuts. That would be a key to the approach she adopted. This is not unfamiliar. There's a lot to learn about the specific situations she encounters, for instance, being in a state, what do they call them, right to work, where you don't have to join a union, even though the union is obligated by law to represent you, puts unions in a real bind, but no shortcuts. Her organizing emphasizes individual contacts with workers, spending extensive time talking with people, finding out their sense of what matters, what their issues are, before even deciding what issue the union will take up. Fascinating example, of course, happened in Connecticut when she talks about kind of geographic organizing in Stamford area, where she brought four unions together. They talked with workers, and they found out that the kinds of issues that really mattered to workers there had to do with their housing outside of workplace. And they organized campaigns that showed people that the union was a worker organization representing the whole range of their interests.
In turn, the community supported them in bargaining and in the struggles they were having with their bosses.
Heavily, right. It's a terrific example of workers as community members pulling together. I do want to mention very specifically, because a lot of unions have got away from workplace issues, there's a lot of national bargaining, a lot of pattern bargaining at a large scale that doesn't deal with what's really going on directly in individual workplaces. Her focus also is on the issues that matter to workers in the workplace.
You know, what was striking about it, seems to me, was what she brought out, workers' sense of responsibility for their patients and for the hospital. The workers learned how to say, we want this hospital to run better, and here's how, and you have to do it. We're not fighting for better wages, though we're doing that, but we're fighting for you to change the way this hospital works in many ways. And I had the sense that working people responded to that because, in fact, they want to work in a workplace where they feel good about it. You spend your life in the part of it, in your workplace. You want to feel that, in fact, it's doing something decent for other people and for your family and for your community. I think that the Portland teachers did exactly the same thing in their recent contract struggle.
There's a vision in this book and in her sense of organizing of unions, not simply as representing the interests of her members as a narrow interest group, as a, what do they call them, special interest groups, but rather unions as agencies for improving everyone's life, for improving especially in the service industries. So you mentioned teachers, of course, and teachers increasingly around the country are seeing teacher unionizing as a way of getting at better education for students.
Yeah, and the schools that Portland and Chicago and Philadelphia and other places, the schools that students deserve. And they're fighting for them, and they really are fighting for them.
And part of her victory in Las Vegas, and it's a tremendous victory, bringing all these for-profit hospitals to heel, was being able to demonstrate to the nurses and to every other worker in the hospital, because the unions that she built were across the board, all workers in the hospital, you know, nurses, down technicians, receptionists, everyone in the same union was showing that healthcare can be improved. And in fact, actually going ahead and improving healthcare through the union.
In fact, she mentions that's the only way to improve healthcare, because no matter how much enforcement there is from the state and regulatory stuff, nothing gets done unless the people on the ground keep watching and making sure that the hospital's not taking shortcuts, not doing all the things that make for higher profits. They have to be the people on the ground who actually provide the service and make sure they have the resources to provide good service.
One last word, Bill. It's a vision that doubly respects the workers. On the one hand, their capability, the way we've been talking about, to build a democratic structure, to participate in, to run these institutions that are a big part of their lives, but also a respect for workers' own dedication to getting a job done that serves other people.
Norm Diamond, you've introduced us to a wonderful book, Jane McAlevey's Raising Expectations and Raising Hell. Norm Diamond, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Good. Good to talk with you. Happy Labor Day, Bill.
We have a special treat today. You remember yesterday we talked to Frank Zappa? Well, today we're going to talk to Mr. William F. Buckley, and he's going to read some fairy tales to us. Don't you go away. He's right here with us right now.
Well, thank you very much. Today, we're going to examine the political social ramifications of Goldilocks and Three Bears. First of all, let's examine her name, Goldilocks. First of all, Goldie, the Aryan stereotype, combined with Locks, the Jewish soul food. Obviously, they're combined to make a sort of bourgeoisie archetype. She is in confrontation versus the Three Bears. They're not dark bears, they're not brown bears. Let's just call them third world bears. And now, in this case, I'm using Goldilocks as an example of imperialism expanding outwards towards the minor race countries, or the third world countries, in the case of the Three Bears. Now, first of all, the Three Bears are out, possibly expanding an expansionist policy on their own, and Goldilocks, as the imperialist, comes in to, once again, she finds some food on the table. One is too hot, let's say this is Marxism. Possibly granola, we don't know. One is too cold, let's say this is hard and cold capitalism. Cold cash, I just use as an analogy. And she chooses the medium, once again, a bourgeoisie attitude, choosing that which is just right. Karl Marx said, eins für ihr und für ihre. I won't translate for you, one day you'll understand. She sits on one chair, it's too hard, possibly this is sexual ramifications, I don't know. One chair is too soft, possibly womb-like, she doesn't want to return back to the womb. Then she chooses once again the medium way, and the chair breaks, obviously showing a certain flaw in her logic. Finally, she goes to the bed. Once again, many of you right now are titillating at that. But now, we get to the best part where she falls asleep. She goes to the bed, one against us, one is too hard, we've pursued that before, one is too soft. Once again, she pursues the median, falls asleep. Now, Into this, the bears returning to their homeland enter their sleep. Why they don't eat her, I don't know. Tune in tomorrow and see when we examine the political, social, and geometric possibilities of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host. We just heard Robin Williams giving us another rousing political impersonation of William F. Buckley from his late 70s comedy routine Reality. What a concept. After another musical interlude, I will wrap up the show talking with Kathy Weeks, a professor of women's studies at Duke University, about utopianism in her book, The Problem with Work. I'm now on the line with Kathy Weeks, professor of women's studies at Duke University, where she teaches about utopian studies and feminism. She is also the author of a book that we talked about before on the Old Mole called The Problem with Work: Feminism, Marxism, Anti-Work Politics, and Post-Work Imaginaries. Welcome back to the Old Mole, Kathy.
Hi, Joe. It's good to be with you.
Well, when we talked about this book before, we didn't really take up the topic of utopianism much. And so I wanted to return to it today so that we could try and build some bridges between labor and how we remember it and the utopian nature of the demands that characterized the labor movement during the last century or so. Let's begin with what you mean by utopianism in your book, The Problem with Work. What are the roots of this concept?
Well, let's start maybe with what I think utopianism is not. It's not a state of impossible perfection. And I think it's this really negative definition of utopianism that's, you know, seen to produce a kind of escapism, political apathy, and inaction. So by this version, you know, utopias are just these idle speculations of beautiful worlds that in reading them we can gain some kind of compensation for our terrible lives. I think this really negative and dismissive definition of utopia really comes from the camp of the anti-utopians. And I think it's been a way historically, utopianism has been dismissed as at best naive, at worst an exercise in a kind of authoritarian prescriptivism. So the way that I really want to think about utopia is much broader, and I think it's a much more modest version of what utopianism is. I think it's best understood as an effort to imagine a better, though not perfect, society. So by this account, utopianism may be, or a specific utopia may be as yet unrealized, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's unrealistic. So, you know, early examples include the form of the traditional literary utopia from Thomas More's 16th century utopia to work by Edward Bellamy or Charlotte Perkins Gilman in the 19th century, all of which take us on a tour of some strange and wonderful place and time. So we might be able to think of this as a kind of traditional literary utopia of the old left. But in the 1970s in the U.S. and elsewhere, there was a kind of a revival of utopian fiction, with particularly science fiction writers like Ursula Le Guin, Samuel Delaney, others. And Tom Moylan has written this great book, and it's about to be reissued. It's called Demand the Impossible. And he names this kind of utopian writing the critical utopia. So these are examples of critical utopias. And critical utopias are much more willing to recognize the ways that every example of utopian speculation is just an ongoing process of imagining and creating. And these are endless partial visions of always better but never perfect possibilities. Right? So it's, again, a very modest version of what you're trying to produce when you produce some kind of utopian vision. So we might want to think of these as sort of utopias of the new left in that sense.
So what happened to these utopias of the new left?
After this period that I was just mentioning in the 1970s, where you get a kind of revival of interest in utopian forms of, you know, speculation, whether it's theoretical or literary or artistic, I think that was very quickly shut down in the 80s and 90s, where there was a kind of retreat from utopianism. And I think the reasons for this are complicated, but I think it's associated with the kind of backlash against left social movements that sort of put left movements more on the defensive. And I think being on the defensive is not conducive to stepping back and thinking in larger sort of utopian terms. And I think in this period, you know, so in this period of kind of neoliberal entrenchment through the 80s and the 90s, I think that old anti-utopian concept of utopia as, you know, as unrealistic, as naive, as some authoritarian know-it-all blueprint of a, you know, minutely planned, perfectly regimented future, I think that older anti-utopian version of utopia gained some traction again amongst the left. And I think in that period, you know, in a period where, you know, as Margaret Thatcher famously pronounced, there is no alternative, I think in that period, the left, too, was less inclined to sort of defend the value of utopian speculation. So I think it's been an ongoing sort of process of the flowering of utopian reflection and then a kind of backlash against that and a retention of this more anti-utopian perspective.
And then there are those who would short-circuit the anti-utopian position by saying that really the utopian devils these days aren't those proposing dramatically different worlds, but those who imagine explicitly or implicitly that the world as it exists now, under capitalism, can continue to exist without collapse or major transformation.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a useful kind of rhetorical strategy, is to ask, well, who's really being utopian here? And that's one way to kind of ask people to really define what they're calling utopian. And if utopia means unrealistic, well, okay, who's more guilty of that?
Yeah, I like how Slavoj Žižek points out that our revolutionary or utopian demand or demands don't have to be totalistic blueprints for the future to come. What they need to be are strategic demands that, in refusing or dismissing them, expose the ideological nature of the thinking around them by so-called pragmatic critics.
I'm very much in favor, and I, you know, that's part of what I've written about, of, you know, the power of what I think of as sort of utopian demands. So demands not for some vision of a perfect alternative, but a demand for a specific kind of reform, but a reform that it's not just a simple reform, but aims for some kind of partial but still more substantial kind of social change. So again, it's not a demand for a utopian society, but a call for a specific reform that still might produce a kind of shift in, you know, the conditions of our lives, but also in terms of, you know, how we can think about what it's possible to want and demand. As I see it, a utopian demand is not impossible to achieve, but it may be a demand that would be difficult to achieve in the short term, a demand for which you have to imagine a kind of longer trajectory of struggle.
Yeah, and in your book, The Problem with Work, you write a lot about how basic income could or even should serve as this utopian demand in our contemporary context. And one thing that I have thought about over the few years that I've been reporting on and examining basic income on the Old Mole is that it's important how we formulate this demand. So, for example, as basic income has been gaining attention in the mainstream media, its proponents still speak in terms of stabilizing the economy, eliminating welfare state programs, boosting aggregate demand, and all of these other things that speak to the values of the profit system that exploits not just human labor, but the world too. And so I think it's important to kind of be upfront with some of these long-range possibilities, even in making the demand, like what would happen if we disinvested labor from socially or environmentally destructive industries?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's one of the advantages of this kind of utopian demand is that on the one hand, you know, and this is sort of this contradiction between it being utopian and it being a demand. As a demand, it has to be fairly legible. It has to be recognized as a plausible possibility that people can recognize in the current moment. But as a utopian demand, it really does present the possibility of some pretty dramatic shifts. I mean, if people are given the possibility to maybe exit at least for some time from work, or if because they have an independent income, they have a better bargaining position to demand better work, this could give workers quite a bit of leverage in some ways and allow them to be, you know, not independent, not break with the wage system necessarily, but again, give them a better position, you know, to kind of lessen the direct link between waged work and income in some ways. And, you know, it, as a legible, plausible kind of reform, I think it can be a talking point. It, you know, people will be able to discuss it. But it's also something that could produce some more dramatic shifts in the way that we think about what we do with our lives. I mean, it also forces us to ask some questions about, well, what would we do with our lives if we weren't required to work our lives away? I mean, I think there's all these possibilities to open up, you know, some broader conversations about the meaning of work in our lives as individuals and socially too.
Well, that's all the time that we have for today. I've been talking with Kathy Weeks about utopianism and its discontents. Kathy Weeks is a professor of women's studies at Duke University and the author of The Problem with Work, which we talked about before on The Old Mole, and we'll link you to on the website. Thanks again for talking with us, Kathy.
Thanks, Joe. It was good to talk to you.
In the gloom of mighty cities, mid the roar of whirling wheels, we are toiling on like chattel slaves of old. And our masters hope to keep us ever thus beneath their heels, and to coin our very lifeblood into gold. But we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem when each man can live his life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor and there's joy and peace for all in the commonwealth of toil that is to be. They would keep us cowed and beaten, cringing meekly at their feet. They would stand between each worker and his bread. Shall we yield our lives up to them for the bitter crust we eat? Shall we only hope for heaven when we're dead? But we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem when each man can live his life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor and there's joy and peace for all in the commonwealth of toil that is to be. They have laid our lives out for us to the utter end of time. Shall we stagger on beneath?
Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. I'm Joe Clement, your host for the Old Mole Variety Hour. You can tune in next week at 9 a.m. to hear more news, reviews, interviews, and analysis from our radical perspective. Tune in online at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour to listen to this again. And thanks to Bill Resnick and Norm Diamond, Nathan Schneider and Kathy Weeks for their contributions, and happy Labor Day.
When our cause is all triumphant and we claim our Mother Earth and the nightmare of the present fades away, we shall live with love and laughter, men who now are little worth, and we'll not regret the price we have to pay. But we have a glowing dream of how fair the world will seem when each man can live his life secure and free. When the earth is owned by labor and there's joy and peace for all in the commonwealth of toil that is.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Giants of Jazz and Blues, a benefit concert for American music program.
Giants of Jazz and Blues will take place on Friday, September the 5th, from 7:30 p.m. to 10 p.m. and features woodwind virtuoso Benny Maupin and acclaimed trumpet player Terrell Stafford, who will be joined by numerous well-known Portland musicians, including Rebecca Kilgore, Andy Stokes, LaRonda Steele, and more.
The concert will be held at the Winningstead Theater, 1111 Southwest Broadway in Portland. Again, that's Giants of Jazz and Blues, a benefit concert for the American Music Program. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 10 a.m. You have it tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll hear an excerpt from Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein. He'll be talking about the disabled nuclear plant at Fukushima and a lawsuit against TEPCO, the company that owns it. At 10:15, we'll hear Locus Focus with host Barbara Bernstein. Today's guest is writer Michelle Nyehouse, whose article, Can Coal Ever Be Clean?, appeared in the April issue of National Geographic. At 11 on the Monday Radio Zine, we'll hear a piece from the series Sea Change Radio with host Alex Wise. Today's guest is David Rolfe, president of the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU 775. They'll be talking about the economy versus the environment. And at 11:30, it's Madness Radio with host Will Hall. We'll hear voices and visions from outside mental health. And we'd like to extend a big thank you to all our listeners that support this radio station. If you've not yet made your commitment to non-commercial community radio, surf on over to kboo.fm and click on the tip jar. So now let's hear